from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, a crisis continues at the border of the United States and Mexico as the surge of unaccompanied, undocumented minors continues, estimated to be presently 10 times the number that came to the United States in 2011. The numbers from Mexico itself are actually decreasing with just over 17,000, but in 2013, nearly 20,000 came from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, with this year's numbers expected overall to reach up to 60,000. Shelters are overflowing and political positions are once again polarized while the president has declared a humanitarian crisis and the House Judiciary Committee prepares to hold hearings beginning tomorrow. We'll discuss the crisis in the hour ahead and hear different perspectives, causes, and possible solutions next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The House Judiciary Committee prepares to hold hearings beginning tomorrow on what to do about the surge of children crossing the United States-Mexico border. According to the Obama administration, 52,000 unaccompanied minors have entered the country since October. Most are seeking refuge from the drug violence in Central American countries. President Obama has declared the surge in arrivals up 90% from last year an urgent humanitarian situation. Critics blame the crisis on the president, saying his lax deportation policies have encouraged people to come to the United States illegally. We want to discuss in this hour the ongoing crisis, including the conditions in detention facilities where children are being held and what should be done. Joining us is Mark Rosenblum. He's Deputy Director of U.S. Immigration Policy Program for the Migration Policy Institute and joins us from the nation's capital this morning. Welcome, Mark Rosenblum.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Good to have you here with us. And also with us this morning is Ira Melman, Media Director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform. And he's with us in Seattle. Welcome, Ira Melman.
Thank you very much.
And also glad to have Ruthie Epstein, who is Policy Analyst with the American Civil Liberty Union's Washington Legislative Office, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Ruthie Epstein.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have all of you. And Mark Rosenblum, let me begin with you, if I may. Let's talk first about what is behind this surge. I mean, on the one hand, there's a lot that's been attributed to violence, crime violence and cartel violence and the like. And yet a lot is simply, as I said in my introduction, from many people's perspective, the result of the president's deferring deportations.
Well, I mean, there's definitely something going on in these three countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, because we're really only seeing a surge from those countries. So if it was generally, you know, a function of deferred deportations, then you would expect to see, you know, a broader increase in inflows. And we're not seeing that. And in fact, Mexican unauthorized migration from Mexico has been down for the last several years and remains, you know, at historically pretty low levels.
Well, we're seeing levels like we never saw before, and they just continue to increase. And this is a pretty treacherous and harrowing journey. And part of the problem is these deportation proceedings. These young people who are coming here, and by the way, we're not only talking about young people, in some cases hundreds of toddlers even are at these detention centers, are adults in miniature. They have no right to appoint a consul, no one to protect their interests as children in the legal system.
That's right. I mean, there are... special procedures that are in place for unaccompanied children, and you know, and that arguably is contributing in some ways to, you know, to the flow and serving as something of a magnet as word gets back, because while adults can be put into expedited removal proceedings and get repatriated with pretty limited judicial review, the kids are guaranteed, you know, the right to go before an immigration judge and seek humanitarian relief. And that system is very backlogged. So the law also provides that while they're awaiting a hearing, they're going to be placed in a in the least restrictive setting, which typically is placement with a family member, if one can be identified, or with a foster family.
There are a lot of them who are being put with sponsors or family members, as I understand it, even upwards around 80%. But many of them, many family members are also here undocumented or illegal, are they not?
That's right. And so under the law with the unaccompanied children, DHS has to transfer them to the Office of Refugee Resettlement in the Department of Health and Human Services within 72 hours. And HHS is actually the agency that places kids with a family member. So HHS does not have an immigration enforcement role, and that placement, you know, even with an unauthorized family member, you know, is supposed to be enabled by not having DHS involved in that process. And that's a change that, that took place in 2008, or actually, I'm sorry, in 2003. But you know, it's certainly likely the case that some of the family members are reluctant to come forward, and that, you know, that, that whole placement with unauthorized family members adds a complicating wrinkle to you know, processing these kids.
And we're talking with Mark Rosenblum, Deputy Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program with the Migration Policy Institute. I'd just like to have you, if you could, Mark Rosenblum, help us understand again, lay this out for us, again, some of the mitigating factors here. I mean, a lot of these kids come here traveling alone, and they come for a variety of reasons, sometimes because of the poverty, the violence, abandonment, exploitation, deprivation, forced marriages, being forced often or feeling they're going to be forced into the sex trade. There's just a whole range of root causes. But the numbers are staggering, and some people think they have to do also with the fact that the coyotes and those who are in this business of bringing children here are operating a lot more under the radar and are using all kinds of rumors or fabrications, like if you come there, you'll get amnesty right away. You come to the United States, you'll get the benefits, which many of them do, those sorts of things.
Yeah, those smuggling networks, the coyotes or the criminal infrastructure, I mean, that's definitely a big part of what explains this surge. I mean, you've had the bad economic conditions, you've had violence in some of the circumstances that you described. I mean, those have all been growing, but they've also been around for several years. And what seems to be one new thing in the last couple of years is that the smuggling, you know, network or infrastructure offers a much more complete door-to-door service from Central America up to the border. They're offering multiple tries for the same flat rate. If you get, you know, apprehended and repatriated the first time, then, you know, you get another chance, which is that's been how smuggling networks have worked right at the border for many years, but for that to be extended all the way down into Central America is a new development. And anecdotally, we know that as you said, the smugglers are advertising and misrepresenting, you know, what kind of benefits these kids are going to be eligible for. So those are all factors that you know, have contributed to these big numbers. And as you said, I mean, the numbers really are quite large, and they've grown, you know, very dramatically in the last 2 or 3 years.
Now, what about enforcement? I mean, certainly a lot is being blamed on the lack of enforcement or enforcement not being efficacious enough. How do you see it?
Well, you know, one thing that we don't see with this current surge is we don't see a lack of border security per se. I mean, there's no kids, or, you know, we're not aware of any significant number of kids who are getting to the border and evading Border Patrol. What they're doing is getting to the border and presenting themselves to Border Patrol. So where the weakness is that we have very limited capacity to quickly process people once they're apprehended. And you know, part of the reason for that is when you look over the last decade or so, we've invested a lot of resources at the border and on the enforcement infrastructure per se, but we've invested much less in immigration courts and in our processing capacity. And with sort of regular unauthorized immigrants who are, you know, who don't have some of these mitigating circumstances, that has been managed by deporting a lot more people without giving them sort of a hearing before a judge and without giving them, you know, extensive due process. But with these kids, you know, many of whom have, you know, very real humanitarian claims that are recognized in U.S. law, you have to go through and look at each case individually. And so where the real sort of gap in the system is in the judicial capacity to do that kind of case-by-case review. So that's much more than a border security problem. This is an immigration court problem.
It's a major impediment here, and a formidable one indeed. Mark Rosenblum, again, is Deputy Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program with the Migration Policy Institute. And we ought to say that there is a principle, an international principle, about the best interests of the child, but as a primary consideration, that child principle is not binding in immigration proceedings. I want to bring Ira Melman into this, who's Media Director with the Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR. And in fact, Ira Melman, Jed Johnson, who's the Homeland Security Secretary, said before a Senate Judiciary Committee, we're not facing a lax enforcement problem with the borders. I'm pretty sure you disagree with that.
Well, as Mark pointed out, they are turning themselves over to the Border Patrol in the expectation that they're going to be processed and then sent out into the United States and never removed after that. Under this administration, they have made it very clear that once you're inside the United States, unless you commit some kind of really serious crime, we are not going to make any effort to remove you from the United States. So the word has gone out, get to the United States, get to the border, turn yourselves over to the Border Patrol. You'll go into some kind of detention for a few days, maybe a few weeks, but eventually they will turn you out. They will put you in the custody of relatives or other guardians around the country. And so long as you don't do anything really bad, you're going to get to stay. And so this is beginning to feed on itself. And, you know, it's starting with these countries in Central America. But if we don't think that the rest of the world is paying attention and understanding that if you can get your kid to the border somehow, some way, no matter where you're from, we are going to admit you eventually and allow you to remain, we are going to see this spring up all across the globe, not just with Central American countries.
With these Central American countries, though, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And by the way, I believe I'm correct when I say that Honduras has the highest murder rate of any country right now on the planet. But how many are actually sent back?
Well, the administration hasn't been releasing a whole lot of data. It's not clear that any of them are being sent back. They're being put in detention. The courts are so clogged up that the hearings are not going to take place for quite some time. So they are being released. And, you know, if they show up for their detention, for their hearings, you know, then we'll find out how many are turned back. But the fact of the matter is many of them are never going to show up for those hearings and nobody's ever going to go out there and look for them.
And this escalation is because of essentially, from your point of view, what you're saying, that is, as Kevin McCarthy put it, failure to enforce the law and secure the borders?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question there's violence and poverty in these countries, but that has been a condition that's existed for a long, long time. What has changed is the perception that if you come to the United States illegally, especially if you are under the age of 18 or your family with kids in tow, and by the way, we are admitting entire families who have kids, not just the kids, but the perception is that if you show up, we will allow you in. And then DACA further reinforces it. Even though these kids will not technically qualify for DACA, the whole premise of DACA was that we have some kind of moral or ethical obligation to allow kids, innocent kids who were brought here or sent here to remain. Well, you know, if we had that kind of obligation to the previous wave of people who came under the age of 18, we're going to have that same obligation to the future waves that come under 18. We've established a precedent here that kind of binds us into doing this over and over again because, you know, you'll have some of these same groups out there 4 or 5 years from now saying, well, these kids didn't make the decision to come. We have to allow them to remain. We can't send them away from the only country they've ever known. So the policies that this administration has fostered and the failure of Congress to intervene and establish the primacy, their primacy over immigration policy has led to this situation. DHS came out with a report just 2 years ago anticipating this sort of crisis, and they did nothing to prepare for it. So it's not, this shouldn't have been a surprise to them. DHS saw this coming a couple of years ago.
Well, congressional hearings begin tomorrow. The House Judiciary Committee will hold a hearing, and it's entitled, and this is a pretty revelatory title, an Administration Made Disaster. That's on the South Texas border, surge of these unaccompanied minors. It would seem as if, and when you have people like Senator Cruz talking about why are these just children and so forth, it would seem like there's at least some action being taken along these lines that you're talking about.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're being forced to act now, but it's too little too late. This was a problem, as I said, that was anticipated several years ago, and nobody took steps to try to do something to prevent it. They talked about the need for more family-friendly detention centers along the border. That never happened. It was opposed by groups advocating on behalf of illegal immigrants. So the crisis is self-induced by the policies that this administration has fostered over the 5.5 years that they have been in office, and also the failure to act on information that would have led them to reasonably believe that this was a crisis in the making.
So President Obama working with Mexico, Vice President Biden going to Guatemala, this is all too little too late. It's the flood that can't be stopped.
Well, it can be stopped. Look, you know, what we need to do probably is establish immigration hearing centers right along the border, establish whether the people coming across have any reasonable case to pursue here in the United States, and remove the ones who don't. And, you know, the options are limited. The Anti-Trafficking Act of 2008, where it pertains to children, limits the what can be done, but there are things that still can be done, including setting up hearing procedures right along the border and removing people who have no plausible claim to come into the United States.
In the meantime, these children are being herded like cattle, and Ruthie Epstein, I want to bring you into this discussion. Ruthie Epstein is a policy analyst with the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office. In fact, cattle might be too weak a metaphor here. There were photos released by Texas Democratic Congressman Henry Queller. They were published, in fact, in the Huffington Post. These are pretty horrific conditions at these detention centers, and as I said, you've got hundreds of toddlers there. These are kids, Ruthie Epstein.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Michael, for inviting me to join this important conversation. The ACLU and a number of our colleague organizations from across the country actually filed a massive administrative complaint a couple weeks ago with the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General and Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, detailing over 100 cases, allegations from kids who had been held in CBP custody and reported egregious examples of abuse and mistreatment in CBP custody. That's Customs and Border Patrol, Border Protection, which is the initial apprehending agency first encountering both the kids and adults who are crossing the border right now. So I think it's important to keep in mind throughout the consideration of this crisis and how the government is responding that even though the numbers are up, that is no excuse for inappropriate, abusive, inhumane treatment for kids or adults in custody. And that includes CBP, which was the topic of this particular complaint that we filed, as well as the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which, as Mark mentioned, ultimately has custodial responsibility for the kids who are, for the unaccompanied kids who are apprehended.
Well, the ACLU filed a complaint, so did the National Immigrant Justice Center, all about abuse in these facilities and allegations against border agents. And this has caused quite a firestorm because many of these border agents feel that they're actually giving comfort and, you know, providing things that many of these children need just to sustain themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And the strain and the demands on Border Patrol agents, I don't want to minimize those challenges at all. You know, Border Patrol is not set up to handle kids at this level. The law rightly provides that kids who are apprehended by Border Patrol or other CBP officials and agents transfer the kids as soon as possible to an agency that's better equipped to provide care, protection to meet the immediate medical and other needs of the kids, which is the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Right now, both CBP and ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, are strapped for resources because of the numbers that we're seeing right now.
There is just not the capacity to care for these children. There isn't the capacity and there isn't, frankly, the resources.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, the Obama administration has requested from Congress $1.4 billion to deal with this, as you rightly noted, what the administration has characterized as a serious humanitarian situation. And the president has put FEMA in charge, recognizing that this really is a humanitarian crisis. It's not an immigration crisis. It's a humanitarian crisis that, you know, the UN Refugee Agency, other UN entities, many organizations that have been working for years, if not decades, on U.S. foreign policy in Central America pin on the gang and cartel violence that is taking place in Central America right now, and specifically the countries that we're seeing these kids and families come from, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras.
Are we hearing this mislabeled, Ira Melman, as a humanitarian crisis rather than an immigration crisis?
Well, it is a humanitarian crisis insofar as these kids are being put in dangerous situations. They're being entrusted to smugglers. These are run by criminal organizations. You know, surely along the way, people are going to die. Things are going to happen. So it is a humanitarian crisis in that sense. But it is an immigration crisis because this is a response, a rational response, to the kind of policies that have been implemented in this country over the past 5.5 years. The message is come to the United States illegally. We are not serious about enforcing our laws. We are going to be especially lenient when it comes to unaccompanied minors and families with children. AP reported yesterday that there have been thousands and thousands of entire family units that have shown up at the border and have been admitted to the United States. The administration won't tell anybody how many, but the message is filtering back. And as I said, it's starting with these Central American countries. But as the word spreads around the world, we are likely to see the same kind of situation transpire for many other countries.
And I'd like to hear your response to that, Ruthie Epstein, and particularly in light of the fact that there are false rumors that are pervasive throughout these Central American countries, solo permisos, you know, all you need to reside permanently is to get across the border.
Right. Yeah, I actually have two different responses to two pieces of that point. The permisos, as I understand it, that which is being described as permisos are actually notices to appear, which are the notices that are given by DHS to any immigrant that it's putting into deportation proceedings. And so any perception that that is actually a permit to remain in the United States legally is incorrect. I think it is interesting to actually contemplate what actors are most responsible for propagating this rhetoric that the Obama administration doesn't deport people. And, you know, when in fact the numbers don't bear out that assertion, the Obama administration has deported, removed 2 million people in the course of more than 5 years.
Sent more people back than the Bush administration.
Certainly, exactly. So the facts don't bear it out. I'm not going to argue, though, that the rhetoric might be out there, but I think it's important to recognize who has been the strongest voices of that rhetoric are, in fact, anti-immigrant organizations, anti-immigrant politicians, and pundits who are continuously and falsely propagating this idea that the Obama administration is lax in its enforcement. So it's an interesting twist of what is the actual source of that rhetoric or misperception.
But there's also been rhetoric from the Obama administration that has President Obama has said the DREAM Act and children being allowed an opportunity is probably close to being his number one priority. And that becomes a kind of magnet as well. I mean, this is a very complicated situation in terms of the causes, and we're going to talk more about possible solutions, and we want to hear from you and bring you into the conversation. In fact, let me invite you to join us now, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. You can be a part of the program. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Talking about the United States struggling to cope with the surge of unaccompanied minors from Central America, and you are indeed invited to participate in the program. Again, toll-free, you can join us now, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or post your questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. We're with Mark Rosenblum, Deputy Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program, Migration Policy Institute, Ira Melman, Media Director for FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and Ruthie Epstein, Policy Analyst with the American Civil Liberty Union's Washington Legislative Office. And we'll hear from you, our listeners, when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the rather extraordinary surge of unaccompanied minors who are entering the United States since October, about 52,000 by reckonings of the administration, and most are seeking refuge from the drug violence in Central American countries. The president has declared the surge in arrivals up 90% from last year an urgent humanitarian situation. Critics blame the crisis on the president, saying his lax deportation policies have encouraged people to come to the United States illegally. We're talking also about the conditions in the detention facilities and talking about the fact that these children appearing before immigration judges are still unrepresented. And I ought to mention that the Senate has a comprehensive immigration reform bill, Senate Bill 744, and the House of Representatives companion bill, House of Representatives Bill 15, which seek to address the critical deficiency by including provisions that would mandate appointment of counsel for unaccompanied children. But Congress at this point, of course, has not enacted anything really along these lines, and immigration reform may be a dim dream at this point, or maybe actualized. We have to wait and see. But the judiciary hearings are being held tomorrow. Congressional judiciary hearings begin tomorrow. We're talking with Mark Rosenblum, Deputy Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program with the Migration Policy Institute, Ira Melman, who is Media Director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and Ruthie Epstein, Policy Analyst with the American Civil Liberty Union's Washington Legislative Office. And Ruthie Epstein, since the ACLU has filed a complaint in this we've kind of heard what Ira Melman's ideas might be for a solution to this problem, but I'd like to hear from you in terms of what you're suggesting or what you're recommending.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is obviously an incredibly complex crisis with lots of different causes and lots of different actors that all need to be mobilized to handle as responsibly, effectively, humanely, with due regard for civil liberties and human rights. And I think it's important to emphasize that at bottom, this migration will not be stemmed unless the root causes are addressed, and that needs to happen in Central America. I'm not a foreign policy expert. I will leave it to others to contemplate exactly what needs to happen, but we cannot discount the push factors. In terms of U.S. response, there are a number of issues that the ACLU is monitoring closely. The first is, as you flag, conditions in detention. That includes CBP custody, which was the topic of the complaint that we and National Immigrant Justice Center and a number of other groups filed a couple of weeks ago. But also, you know, last Friday, the administration announced that they would be expanding the use of family detention. Mr. Melman of FAIR pointed out that some years ago, the administration started to consider expanding family detention and decided not to. There was a very good reason for that, and the reason is that family detention is not a good idea. This is not what America should be doing, putting young kids and their mothers and fathers in detention for extended periods of time. In 2007, in fact, the ACLU, the ACLU of Texas, the University of Texas Law School, and a private law firm brought a major lawsuit that was concerned with conditions in a family detention center in Texas, in Taylor, Texas. It was called Deton Hutto, D-T-Don Hutto. And the conditions that our litigation highlighted were extremely abusive, inhumane, inappropriate conditions for kids and their parents to be held in. So I think that we are very worried about that prospect, that possibility rearing its head again, and are urging the administration, to the extent that it decides to use family detention again, that kids and their families be held for the least amount of time necessary in the least restrictive setting possible, in compliance with international and domestic law, existing residential standards for family detention.
Well, let me extrapolate a bit from that, because what you're talking about is obviously necessary. I mean, in terms of better condition, a lot of these children are suffering. There's no getting around that. But what we really need, it seems to me, is some kind of thorough, fair, swift court hearings that can adjudicate and that can also ameliorate the kinds of problems we're talking about. I mean, get safe return, get reintegration programs going, get better routes to family reunification, and have child protective screenings that are more adequate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on that point, you're absolutely right. I think an interesting silver lining of this tremendous crisis is that we are now recognizing the utter under-resourcedness of the adjudication process in this country. As Mark flagged earlier, we don't have enough immigration judges. We don't have enough asylum officers to be adjudicating these cases, and that's what we need.
Well, we also, and I'm going to go to our callers in just a moment, but it seems to me, Mark Rosenblum, we also need more training for Border Patrol and FEMA and other authorities. Better training.
Yeah, I think that clearly, I mean, you know, the Border Patrol agents get certain training to you know, interact with kids and families, but I think that you know, we can all agree that this surge has caught the agency somewhat flat-footed, and that, you know, that's why we've seen some of these complaints emerge. But, you know, when I've spoken to several of the embassies here in Washington from, you know, from the from Central America, and you know, generally they see DHS as really making a pretty heroic effort, and they don't have big complaints. I mean, there are these isolated cases, but I think that this is just a tough situation to get people processed through the system, and they did not have, you know, system-wide, government-wide, we just didn't have the resources in place to move people through and to get those fair adjudications that you're talking about.
Let me go to our callers, and we first are going to hear from Haley. And Haley, you've had some experience in these detention centers?
Yes.
Tell us.
I'm an attorney in San Francisco at a nonprofit, and we work with both kids who are here in the Bay Area in some of these Health and Human Services detention centers, as well as kids who have been released from detention centers in other places around the country to family members or other sponsors here in the Bay Area. And I just wanted to second some of the comments that I've heard. You know, as a legal provider, one of the big challenges, as you mentioned, is that kids are not entitled to any representation in court. And so we see huge numbers of kids going to court unrepresented.
You also see, forgive me, you also see a huge number of kids who don't go to court, too, who just stay away from court.
Well, you know, I can't speak to that as much. We definitely, with the screenings we've done, we have lots of kids. I've met with kids at schools who have gone to court 3 or 4 times alone. The judges will continue their cases and tell them to go find a lawyer, but there aren't enough lawyers who are able to do these cases or so far have been stepping up to do these cases free or for a low cost. And so kids are unable to afford attorneys, and at some point the judges make them go forward on their own. Of course, as a lawyer, I don't see a lot of the cases where they're going alone. I just screen them and hear their stories that they've been to court several times. So my experience isn't that they don't go. I've seen lots of families who do send very young children to court by themselves, and that's, you know, not a good situation for the kids or for the judges. The judges don't like that, obviously. You know, I think increasing the resources for judges to expand the number of judges and expedite cases would be great. We have cases that are pending 3 or 4 years, and that's, again, you know, not...
It's unacceptable.
Not acceptable.
Yeah, thank you, Haley. Good to hear from you. I want to hear from some more callers. Let me go to Michaela next. Michaela, join us. You're on.
Hi. My comment is just on the humanitarian issue that's been brought up, and Honduras having the highest murder rate of any country in the world right now is really alarming, considering the fact that the drug crisis and the cartels and the drug war is largely funded by the U.S. appetite or the North American appetite for drugs. And I think that if we're spending billions of dollars on wars around the world, if not hundreds of billions of dollars, I think that we have a humanitarian responsibility to children that are facing murder, rape, the sex trade. I think we have a responsibility to the fact that we are the consumers of the drugs. They are our neighbors, and I don't have a problem with these kids coming, honestly.
All right. I thank you for expressing your opinion. And Ira Melman, how much of this problem, from your perspective, has to do with Mexico?
Well, it has to do with, obviously, with the conditions in those countries, as several of the other people have mentioned, that there are a lot of push factors. And to the extent that we can do something constructive to ameliorate those situations, we should.
No, but what I'm asking you is, they come through Mexico, and Mexico has no problem with putting illegals in their country, or undocumented people, whatever you want to call them, in jail. But it seems like when it works the other way, they can get through Mexico.
You're absolutely right. The Mexican government turns a blind eye to the transportation of illegal immigrants through Mexico. As long as they don't remain in Mexico, the Mexican government doesn't seem to care. The United States should be working with the Mexican government to try to get them to interdict people before they reach the border. But again, the one thing that we have control over in this situation are the pull factors. We can't deal with all the push factors. It gets us into the realm of nation building. We have a proven track record of not doing that very well. But what we can do is send a very, very clear message that we are not going to allow people to come en masse to the United States illegally because we simply can't sustain it. It's not because we don't recognize the situations in these countries. It's because this simply isn't a viable solution to the problems that exist in those countries. All we are doing is inducing more people to come, endangering people's lives as they try to get here to the United States with no end in sight. So what we need to do is address the push factors to the greatest extent possible. But in terms of the pull factors, we have complete control over that, and we ought to exercise that control.
All right. I want to go to some of the emails here. Wendy writes, I always understood that Mexico's southern borders were much less porous than ours. If these children come from south of Mexico, how did this number of children pass through Mexico's borders? That was really the intent of my question. You want to respond to that, perhaps, Mark Rosenblum?
Sure. Well, just one small point is that Mexico actually passed sort of their own comprehensive immigration reform bill in 2011, and it's no longer a criminal offense to be unauthorized in Mexico. So they used to throw unauthorized immigrants in jail in Mexico. They don't do that anymore. But Mexico's border with Guatemala, I would say, is much more porous than ours. It's largely, jungle. And there's a shortage of formal crossing points and a lot of informal crossing points and very limited infrastructure. So that's something that Mexico has been investing in, and the U.S. has been providing some assistance to sort of tool up at the Mexico-Guatemala border. And there's other enforcement that is done sort of between the border, between the southern border and the northern border, and those are actually sort of more important intervention points. We know that a lot of these kids are coming on the cargo trains that, that head north through Mexico, and that are, just horrendous circumstances on the trains, and a lot of smuggling networks that exploit those trains. And so, clearly, the numbers coming through indicate that at some point, at various points in Mexico, there is enforcement that's not taking place that probably could, including under Mexican law. So that's certainly, something that I think the U.S. and Mexico, are aware of and looking at. But there's work to be done.
And as I said earlier, President Obama did speak with President Nieto of Mexico. What came out of that at this point in terms of action? Unclear. Let me read some of your comments online. Kurt writes, where is the urgent humanitarian crisis? There is no war, there is no hurricane, no floods, no drought. There are gangs, but we have more than our share of gang violence here in the old USA. Why not go to Costa Rica and apply for asylum? It's much closer. Frank writes, how heartless and irresponsible it is for parents to send their children on a long and perilous journey to have them fend for themselves in a foreign country. How heartless and irresponsible it is for parents to effectively demand strangers and American taxpayers to shoulder the burden of dealing with their kids. How heartless and irresponsible it is for parents to produce more children than they can afford, and in so doing condemn those children to a life of excruciating poverty. And on our Facebook page, Carol writes, actually, I agree with the gentleman about the fact that more and more immigrants will come across borders to countries that are haves. Western Europe is seeing this in mass numbers from Africa, Lebanon, from the war-torn countries around it, and the United States from the entirety of South America. In a time of media available to all, the have-nots of the world will never let the haves continue to accumulate all the wealth of the world over time. Bob writes online, the USA and its many decades of meddling in Central American countries as well as around the world is the proximate cause of the extremely high murder and violence rate in some of the Central American countries. Like Iraq, we broke the place and now refuse any responsibility to fix it. And Kurt writes online, how many of the children die and how many are being raped and who is orchestrating this? How does an undocumented minor get united with an undocumented parent? Do these kids all have cell phones? Are their parents tweaking them? Any foreign country should know this is our soft underbelly. One more online comment from a listener who writes, are we taking this at face value? Could the stream of children be a distraction, possibly by drug dealers or terrorists? I'm not paranoid. I'm just a born skeptic. More of your calls. William, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. The email has covered some very important things. I would appreciate Mr. Melman's perspective, because he's been involved in immigration policy for a long time, as to what degree the NAFTA arrangement, which with the subsidized U.S. crops drove the Mexican farmers out of business, and the drug violence, which is promulgated because of drug use in the United States, to what extent those, what I would call push factors, have contributed to the current problem?
Ira Melman.
Well, they very well may have contributed, but it is not entirely the responsibility of the United States. As I recall, there were three signatures on the NAFTA treaty, including the president of Mexico's. So, you know, it may be a bad trade deal. You know, I'll let other people make the determination about that. Clearly, there was displacement from in some areas of Mexico. There's been displacement of workers here in the United States as a result of that. But, you know, let's fix NAFTA. You know, the answer isn't to put all the blame on the United States and say, because we were one of the three signatories to that document, that suddenly we're responsible for anybody who is displaced in Mexico or, for that matter, Canada.
Let me thank the caller and move right on to a caller from Sonora, Mexico. Eric, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you to the panel very much. I was an activist during the 2000s that was very involved with the deluge of Mexicans going into the United States. And we used the churches back then as harbors, which is somewhat legal. There were organizations such as No More Deaths. And then also, the Mexicans are only they're only the passage right now from Honduras to the United States. There's a song called The Ballad of Eddie Decoy that tells about, back in 2004, that told about the people getting on tops of trains and going into Mexico and making it legally. There were less people on the planet back then. My question is, what can people do right now at that Honduran border, Guatemala border, because they can't do much at the Mexican border right now? I live here full time and I see this. It's not even on the news here. We are only the route from Central America to the United States.
Mark Rosenblum, let me defer to you on this. He's asking what can be done about the Honduran and Guatemalan and El Salvador borders. Some thoughts?
I mean, you know, there are sort of enforcement responses and investments to, you know, create alternative, you know, opportunities for people to encourage, you know, to give them reasons not to leave. But I do think it's important to recognize, I mean, several of the comments that you read, the emails that you read, and Mr. Melman's comments that, you know, suggest that this is just a general phenomenon that's going to be happening from other countries. And I do think that that these three countries in Central America are fairly exceptional for their history of immigration to the U.S. and the really bad circumstances that exist there right now. You mentioned that Honduras has the number one murder rate in the world. Guatemala and El Salvador are number four and number five. And the UNHCR, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, recently looked at this crisis and determined that 58% of the unauthorized kids who are showing up have potentially legitimate humanitarian claims, you know, that under international agreements that the U.S. has signed on to, that, you know, that the U.S. is obligated to offer them relief. And that wouldn't describe, you know, general flows to the U.S. that might, you know, seek to take advantage of this. So, you know, any interdiction we do to sort of force people back to Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador, you know, should include adequate due process and legal representation to sort through and to recognize the legitimate humanitarian claims that exist. And you know, and it's important to make those longer-term investments in the countries to address those push factors.
Let me go back to the caller. Eric, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So you said you're seeing this surge. I mean, there in Sonora, you're actually witnessing these numbers coming through. Give us a kind of detailed sense of what you're observing, if you could.
Exactly. You're seeing a border state like Sonora, which borders Arizona, and you're seeing them coming through Texas right now. But what we have is people not making it across. You guys are talking about the the thousands and thousands that are getting caught or turning themselves in. There's the melting pot here at the border, which is stuck at the border, who are selling chiclets at the border, trying to make enough money just to eat, and they're mostly Central American. This is what, you know, what can we do about this? This is a question of the thousands that are still in Sonora. And there's the thousands you guys are not even talking about. You guys are talking about the thousands and thousands. I'm talking about the ones that are stuck in Sonora that have to get back on their own. If they do go back, they're going to get in trouble. They're going to get killed by the gangs, da-da-da-da-da. There's a monumental problem here. We're going to start an organization here in northern Sonora to try to help out the situation. Whether it be through the church or new organizations or through the tourists down here, I don't know. But I'm getting philosophical with you, but it's a terrible situation.
Yeah, we're getting the message. Yeah. We're getting it loud and clear. And thank you for that report. I appreciate your call, Eric from Sonora, Mexico. Ruthie Epstein, I want to go back to you on something. A caller earlier who said, actually the first call we had from an attorney who said that there are lots right here in San Francisco of young people who are turning up, undocumented young people. But according to the Justice Department, there and I had mentioned this earlier, and I wanted to give the statistic out because I think it's important, about a quarter simply don't turn up in court.
Yeah, I think this is where it's important to use all the tools at our disposal. Detention is not the only way to ensure that folks show up for their hearings, and in fact, it's clearly the most restrictive and least humane tool. Alternatives to detention are widely used in the pretrial context in the criminal justice system and are beginning to be expanded in the immigration enforcement system. And so at this time when DHS is facing these unprecedented arrivals and putting every single one of these kids into deportation proceedings, I think it's very important to note that no one is not being put into deportation proceedings. To help ensure compliance with court hearings, it would behoove the department to continue to invest in alternatives to detention. That can include anything from an electronic ankle bracelet to much less restrictive and often more appropriate things like home check-ins, telephonic call-ins. And these means are proven effective. They're certainly less costly. The most recent stats we have show a compliance rate in the high 90s.
Do you know if there's any attempt to put money into those kinds of things? I mean, there's money that's being essentially earmarked for the kind of problems we've been talking about. Anything along the lines you've just outlined? Do you know?
I don't know firsthand, but I would be stunned if it weren't on the table in discussions, because it's really the only large-scale tool that the administration has at its disposal that's actually affordable.
Let me bring another caller on, and that's you, Kelly. Thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Hi. So thank you for taking my call, by the way. I love your show. I've been listening to all of the Facebooks and emails, and, you know, a lot of what I'd like to say has been said already, but, you know, my thoughts are directed towards Ira Melman, is that I think that you saying, you know, we need to send out a message saying that, you know, you can't just dump your kids here. I think you're missing the bigger part of the problem is that we, as the United States, as a superpower, supposedly, you know, where we have this somehow right to go into Iraq and to go into Afghanistan, and in the name of either, you know, doing away with terrorists or dealing with whatever issue, I think that a number one, this issue is not an immigration issue. It's an absolute humanitarian issue, because just maybe philosophically speaking, is if you knew somebody that had children that were being detained in those deplorable conditions, I don't think that it'd be easy for you to say, oh, no, well, we just need to send a message and say, hey, you can't come to our country for free, and, you know, we can't bear this burden. I think as a world superpower, we have the absolute responsibility to do whatever we can in helping these kids that clearly, you know, one of the emails I believe said that how heartless it is for parents to send over their children unattended. I think that we also need to look at it as, I think they were willing to risk that because there is still the belief that this country does provide relief for the needy and the poor. And I think that as America, we should come up with a better solution than just, you know, coming up with more staunch immigration reform, because clearly it's not working. This is not an issue that has been that's a new issue. There was Governor Pete Wilson that was also years ago that was opposed to this sort of thing. So I just think that it's an absolute humanitarian issue, and I think that blaming the Obama administration, who actually has deported more than the Bush administration, I don't think that that's a solution to this problem.
Kelly, thank you for the call. Let me go to Ira Melman.
Well, first of all, with regard to deportation, the statistics are being cooked because they're counting people that they catch at the border, turning them over to ICE, and ICE gets credit for the deportation, which has never happened before. But in terms of dealing with this, and yes, there is a humanitarian component. When people, or especially kids, are put on trains or entrusted to smugglers and sent to the United States, that becomes a real humanitarian issue. But, you know, you argue that we against the intervention in Afghanistan and Iraq. And yet, you know, the only alternative to dealing with the people who are coming here would be to go and intervene in these Central American countries, which clearly the American public doesn't want to happen. If it's a humanitarian crisis, if it's truly a humanitarian crisis, then we ought to be dealing with this as an international body. The United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees ought to be involved. The resettlement obligations ought to be spread around the world. It can't all be the United States' responsibility. We don't have the resources to deal with many of the needs in this country. It's just not realistic to expect that we're going to be able to deal with all the kids, the needs of the kids in Central America and from other parts of the world.
Well, let me read a couple more online comments before we sign off here. One listener writes, easy solution, make it very clear that anyone who brings an unaccompanied minor will never be legalized, get a green card, citizenship, whatever, and neither will the minor. Separate the humanitarian issue from the issue of our corrupt government's failed immigration policy of tolerating undocumented hiring ever since 1986. If the U.S. taxpayers want to provide shelter to these folks for however long they want to, even as we will not provide subsidized housing to our own very poor citizens, so be it, but make it clear they will never be legalized, get a green card or citizenship. Another listener writes, pardon me, but I think your guests are speaking as if they're from another planet. To spend resources giving hearings, long detentions is absurd. And another guest says, I'm not surprised this is happening, given the wait time to legally sponsor a child from Mexico. As an example, it takes anywhere from 10 to 20 years, another wrinkle in this very complex problem. And I think we have certainly shed light on it. I hope we have. I want to thank Ira Melman from FAIR and Mark Rosenblum from Migration Policy Institute and Ruthie Epstein from the ACLU. And you, our listeners, another hour ahead. In the hour ahead, we're going to talk about how to get along better in the workplace, not only with fellow workers, people, that is fellow employees, but also your bosses. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.